Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Stephen Dobbs, Vice President of the Tobey Philanthropies and Tobey Family Foundation. This program is part of our Tobey American Values series, underwritten by the Tobey Family Foundation. It is my pleasure to welcome tonight's speaker, Ben Stein, actor, writer, attorney, professor, and financial expert. You may know him for his portrayals of the deadpan high school teacher in the film Ferris Bueller's Day Off, a scene recently ranked as one of the 50 most famous scenes in American film history. I'm sure he's very proud of it. Or you may remember Ben from his game show, Win Ben Stein's Money, which has won 7 Emmys. You may also know Ben Stein for his prolific writings on the economy, business, and politics. After helping to found the Journal of Law and Social Policy while at Yale University, Stein worked as a poverty lawyer and then as a trial attorney dealing with trade regulation at the Federal Trade Commission. He also served as a speechwriter and lawyer for both Presidents Richard Nixon and Gerald Ford. And I'm here tonight to tell you he did not write the line, "I am not a crook." Ben has taught political, legal, financial, and ethics courses at several major universities, including American University in Washington, D.C., UC Santa Cruz, and Pepperdine. He is a regular columnist, as many of you are familiar, at the New York Times, and has also written for the Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Los Angeles Herald Examiner, Barron's, LA Magazine, New York Magazine, E! Online, and The American Spectator, and Yahoo Financial. Stein has written 16 books, in fact, both fiction and nonfiction, on finance, ethics, and socio-political works, including his most recent with the tantalizing title, How Not to Ruin Your Life. Ben Stein appears regularly on the Fox News Channel to discuss finance issues, and he is a regular commentator on the CBS Sunday Morning News. He lives in Southern California with his wife, son, 4 cats, and 2 dogs. Please welcome Ben Stein.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Actually, I just want to say it's a pleasure to be here. I almost never do unpaid speaking gigs, but I'm doing this one because it's an incredibly distinguished group. You're all distinguished people. And also, my father did it in 1972, so I feel I should do it too. I want to also say, I did not write the line, "I am not a crook." I actually wrote a speech saying, "I am a crook," and they changed it a little bit. And I think my line would have been better, and he might have been able to stay in office. People, honestly, as Mr. Nixon said to me once when I was talking to him, honesty may not be the best policy, but it's worth trying every once in a while. Anyway, we just sort of tried it a little tiny bit more often. Anyway, thank you again for being here. Seems like just yesterday that I was sitting in the audience. It wasn't this building. It was another building where my father was speaking, and boy, time flies. And I just would like to say I love, love, love being here in San Francisco, even on a cold, rainy, cloudy, miserable, drizzly day. I love being here. I have a sister who is a few years older than I am, but she has a wealthy husband, so she spends most of her life exercising and traveling. And she called me a few days, she called me actually this afternoon, just as I was coming up from the airport, and she said, "I'm in Turin, Italy. I'm Torino, as they call it sometimes, and I've just been on the Stairmaster for a half hour, and I was on the treadmill for 45 minutes before that. What exercise have you done today, Benji?" And I said, "Well, aside from eating 5 pieces of huffy bacon, I am right now about to get into the most beautiful city in America. I'm about to get to my hotel room, look out the window at the beautiful San Francisco Bay, look across the bay at Berkeley, look over at the Golden Gate Bridge, and then I'm going to say to myself, Benji, you are in the most beautiful city in the world, in the most beautiful state in the world, in the most beautiful country in the world, and then I'm going to get on my knees and thank God for it, and that will be my exercise, Rachel. Thank you very much. Anyway, so I usually begin my remarks with a whole bunch of jokes, but because I'm very pressed for time, I'm only going to tell you two little, really actually not jokes exactly, but funny stories that were told to me by Milton Friedman, the great genius economist who used to live here in San Francisco and loved San Francisco. The first one is about this old Jewish man is sitting on a park bench in South Beach, Florida, and another old Jewish man comes up to him and says, Bernie, it's Dave from the old neighborhood back in Flatbush. My God, I haven't seen you in 40 years. You look great. What has become of you? And he said, well, I was in the folding box business. I did well, and I retired, and I'm down here. And the other one says, yeah, but you had three lovely sons. What happened to those sons? They were great kids. And the other guy says, well, one of them was really good with his hands, really good with his hands. He could do anything. He went to medical school at Harvard. Then he became a neurosurgeon at Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles. He does incredibly complex brain surgery that nobody else can do. And he's saved many, many, many lives. And they play Exodus when he's in the operating room. And he's just an amazing guy. And the other one says, well, that's great. Now, the second one had a big mouth. He could just argue about anything. What was he like? What happened to him? The other one says, well, he went to Harvard College and then to Yale Law School, and he became a clerk for Justice Souter, and then he became appointed to the Federal District Court, and now he's on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, and they say he's on the short list for the Supreme Court. The other one says, that's incredible. That's amazing. Now, he said, I don't want to get in trouble here, but the third son was the best looking of all. But I remember he was going to summer camp in the Poconos, and he had an accident. He fell off a horse, and he got kicked in the head by the horse, and he had some brain damage. What happened to him? The other one said, oh, he's doing the best of anybody. He's on TV all the time, and he's really, really happy, and I'm surprised you haven't seen him. And the other one says, well, what can he do? What can he possibly do on TV with a brain injury like that? And the other said, it's easy. He forecasts business cycles on CNBC. Anyway, that's a joke about how hard it is to forecast business cycles. And then the same similar joke was that when I first started appearing on CNBC myself, and I asked Friedman for any advice he had about it, he said, well, there's only one rule about predicting successfully in economics. Predict often. Anyway, let's talk about the economy. I have a million, trillion more jokes, but I'm under very strict time rules here. The economy. Basically, my view of it is it's nowhere near as bad as some people in the media are saying. For the markets to be off as much as they are, the stock markets, it would imply a drop of close to 20% in profits this year, and every other year for the next 25 years. Nothing like that has ever happened, unless there's nuclear war or some kind of plague. Nothing like that is ever going to happen. So unless some factors at work here that I can't figure out and no one else has figured out, the market is way oversold. Second thing is people are endlessly talking about the losses in subprime, and it's been a real, real problem. $100 billion so far, but people will recover a lot of that because the houses will be seized, sold in foreclosure. Even if the number is double that, it seems like a lot of money, and you and I could have a lot of fun with $200 billion, even if we divided it just, I imagine there are about 200 people in this room, that would be each of us about $100 million. And but we could have a lot of fun now they think of it. Anyway, next time around, guys, we're going to sell subprime mortgages. But anyway, but it is a very, very small amount of the wealth of a nation that has aggregate wealth of about $65 trillion. So, and it's a tiny fraction of what was lost in the tech collapse in the beginning of the century. So it's really not as terrible as it seems and as the media plays up. The media likes to play up bad news. And in a way, I was thinking as I was writing my speech, in a way, there was no loss at all because a lot of people got to borrow money and didn't have to pay it back. So, and it reminds me of one of my rules for life, which is that if you're going to borrow money, don't pay it back. Because if you borrow money and pay it back, you're basically in the same position you were in before. But if you don't pay it back, you're way to the good. But anyway, as to a recession, we don't know if we're in a recession. We cannot possibly conceivably know if we're in a recession because a recession, generally as it's defined, is 6 months of declining economic activity. Obviously, you can't know that 6 weeks into it. It's like saying that at age 30, you know how old you're going to be, how old you're going to live. You can't know that. So we don't know for sure. We won't know for several months. If we are in a recession, just a few things to keep you calm down. The average recession in the post-war era is 10 months. It's too long and it's uncomfortable, but it's not the end of the world. The average recession in the last 25 years has only been 6 months, and there have only been two of them. There's never been a recession that the Fed was actually fighting, actually and actively fighting, where retail sales fell for more than 1 year. There's never been a recession where unemployment, when the Fed was fighting, it was more than rose more than 1.75 percentage points. Average unemployment is about 6 weeks. It's uncomfortable, and you sure as heck don't want to be one of the people fired, but it's not the end of the world. We are basically a fantastically prosperous country. Obviously, and I'm going to get to this, the prosperity is very, very, very ill distributed, but it is not, we're not facing a catastrophe, we're not facing the apocalypse. And I think for most of the people in this room, subprime will not affect your life at all. It won't affect your life at all, I'll just say that. Anyway, unless you're going to be indicted for selling fraudulent mortgages. I don't think we have a real problem with inflation. The big numbers coming out about inflation had to do with oil prices. They were fed primarily by demand from India and China and the developing countries of Asia. They cannot be controlled by the Federal Reserve Board. They can't be controlled by the U.S. Central Bank. It's no good hitting a family in Oakland or Berkeley over the head with a brick to stop demand in Beijing or Shanghai. Let's just let the market operate. As the prices rise, people will use less of it. It'll be fine. Food prices were a big increase recently. That comes largely from ethanol mandates. A lot of people think you can grow all the food we need, all the corn we need to supply all our cars with energy. Not even remotely close, not even wildly close. But some people, makes people feel good to have that fantasy, so why not let them do it? Anyway, the Federal Reserve can do some things, though, to affect the slowdown in a positive way. Supply liquidity, bank stop the banks. And I think, by the way, this is something I wrote about in the Times a few days ago. I don't see why the Fed should not go to the banks and say, we are just not going to let you fail. So don't feel shy about lending. Get the cork out and start lending. And if it's required, if the Chinese or the Singapore people or the petrostates won't buy your stock, we'll buy it. After all, banking is already largely socialized. Let's let the Fed step in and buy. And my wacky friend from CNBC, Jim Cramer, has suggested that the Fed buy the mortgage insurance companies, too. Not a bad idea. I mean, he's a wacky guy, but that was a pretty good idea. Anyway, we have not yet figured out how to cure the business cycle. It does look like we're in the downward part of the business cycle now. But overall, we get through them. The overall prosperity of the country is overwhelming, just overwhelming. I don't know if it is in your life, but for the whole country in general, it's overwhelming. Obviously, there are too many poor people, and as I say, it's very poorly distributed. But for the average person in this country, real wages have tripled since 1955. That's a very big increase in 50 years. Real wages after inflation tripling. The average house is almost three times as big as it was in 1955. People have twice as many cars per family as they did. We're a rich country. And by the way, people think, oh, we're not as rich as Japan. We're way richer than Japan. We are much, much richer on a per capita basis than Kuwait. We're much, much, much richer, twice as rich, at least, on a per capita basis as Saudi Arabia. Much richer on a per capita basis than Germany. We're a very, very rich country. More than that, we have made incredible moral progress in this country, at least in my lifetime, and I think on a consistent basis through this country. When I was a child growing up in Maryland and Virginia, we had really serious repressive racial policies in this country. Nasty, awful segregation. Very bad conditions for black people. A black man could be killed for looking the wrong way at a white woman. We had detailed segregation by law in schools, housing, public accommodation, transport. It was humiliating for African Americans. I remember vividly when I would drive in from the suburbs into Washington, D.C., and see the conditions in which many, many of the black people in our nation's capital lived, and just think, this just cannot go on. This just cannot go on. And mercifully, it has not gone on. The situation is far from perfect, but it is incomparably better than it was. The civil rights movement, paid for in blood, has unlocked many, many doors. Not all the doors, but a heck of a lot of the doors. Medgar Evers gave his life for it. Martin Luther King Jr., the greatest man of the 20th century in America, gave his life for it. Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner, Viola Liuzzo. A lot of brave, wonderful people gave their lives for the civil rights movement, but it changed life in America, we hope, for good. For blacks, for women, for Jews, for Asians, for Hispanics, for everyone. It would be impossible to judge how much of a change there's been in this country unless you actually live through it. I mean, when I think that as a child, and when I would go to places in rural Maryland or Delaware or Virginia, routinely there would be segregated water fountains, segregated lunch counters, white trade-only signs up. Even, this is an amazing thing, and people find it hard to believe. When I was a child, the Washington Post, that arch-liberal newspaper, major, major liberal newspaper, even then, had its classified ads broken down by apartments for rent colored, apartments for rent white, jobs colored, jobs white, houses for sale white, houses for sale colored. And even the ones that were for sale for white were usually not for sale to Jews. So it's been a big, big, big change, major, major change. And I think when we think about the problems we face in this country, we should also think about how far we've come. But how far we've come. I mean, to think, if this is 2008, I was an eighth grader in 1958. If in 1958 I had said, there's a black man and a woman running for president on the Democratic ticket, it would have been a setup for a joke. No one would have believed it possible. It would have been the setup for a joke. Now it's really happening. One of them is very likely to be president, and it's an amazing amount of progress. We face several real giant problems, though, economically and morally. One, the baby boomers. Now, I see that many people in this room are in that group, and I assume you are well prepared, but there are 78 million baby boomers racing towards retirement. Of the, in that group, the average savings are $50,000 per household. Now, I don't know about you. I know you people are probably more sensible than I am, but you cannot live for very long on the interest on $50,000. And if you include home equity, it's about $115,000 and shrinking fast. And only 20% have a meaningful pension plan. Most of those are civil servants. The 40% of all baby boomers have no meaningful savings at all. That's a real scary proposition. Tens of millions are going to retire and wind up short. They're going to have to drastically cut back on their lifestyles. Those of you who are listening either here or out in radio land who are in the financial services business, get to work. You need to sell people on saving more, investing more, investing more sensibly. It's a gigantic, gigantic problem. I think it is going to be the biggest problem for America since the Great Depression. Second, closely related, Medicare. Medicare's liabilities, growing at the rate they've been growing, in the next 50 years, if discounted to present value, and ask your children to explain what that means to you, the amount of the indebtedness is so large that it exceeds the entire wealth of the United States. If you took every office building, every car, every airplane, every farm, every silo, every aircraft carrier, every bond, every stock, everything, and put them in one big bond, it would not produce enough income, even using up the capital, to pay for Medicare for the next 50 years. That's a very scary proposition. Third, huge trade gap. We borrow $1.5 billion a day, just for oil. That's just for oil, not counting anything else. That's a lot of money, folks. Even in a country as rich as ours, that's a lot of money. Foreigners are willing to lend it to us, but foreigners are getting to own a very large percent of the United States of America. I know there are countervailing forces, but at some point,
foreigners are going to own so much of America that Americans are going to be working a good chunk of the year to pay interest to foreigners. And at a certain point, foreigners are going to say, we don't want to hold dollars anymore. It keeps going down. We don't want to hold it. We'll hold euros instead. Very scary proposition. Then the dollar will go down more. It's a very bad situation economically when a country is as dependent as we are on loans from foreigners, and there's no end to it in sight. You know, my father famously said, when asked about this question, if a thing cannot go on forever, it will stop. And that's a very good point. And it will stop, but it will. But as you say to your children, when they're playing too wildly, it may end in tears. And I don't see how it's going to end in anything but tears. I mean, there is a solution. I mean, if everyone drove a little teeny tiny car, that would solve the problem. But people don't seem to want to drive little teeny tiny cars. But I think eventually they're going to have to. Next, income inequality. Now, Mrs. Thatcher, I think we all remember Mrs. Thatcher, the former prime minister of the UK, said that income inequality was not a problem. She said, after all, it's not mandatory. No, but there's no law requiring people to be unequal, so it's not a problem. Anyone who works really hard can be rich. Well, that's not quite true. I mean, you can work awfully, awfully hard at McDonald's and not become rich. But I guess you can become rich if you can put yourself in the Wayback Machine and work at Walmart when it was first started. But anyway, income inequality in this country has reached a breathtaking level. You know, we're in war. It doesn't seem like it, but we're in a war. To most of us, we hardly notice it. I notice it a lot because I go to Walter Reed to visit the wounded soldiers a lot. But to most people, unless they're fighting or have family or fighting, we don't even notice we're in a war. But we're in a war, and there has to be some social cohesion. With this level of income inequality that we have in this country, social cohesion is difficult. I'll give you some data. In 2004, the top 130,000 wage earners in this country earned more than the bottom 120 million people in this country. In 2005, the top 300,000 wage earners, and we all want to be them, earned more than the bottom 200 million people. 0.1% of the people in this country own 43% of all the financial assets. The bottom 20%, which is 60 million people, own 1% of all the assets in this country, and most of that is in the form of their cars. That is not a good situation. We have a war going on. People, generally speaking, not always, who are not in the rich group in this country, go off to fight in the war. What they don't know is happening back here at home is that other people who are fantastically rich are having $10 million weddings and $10 million parties for their kid's 13th birthday. To me, and I may just be crazy. In fact, I'm quite sure I am. But the idea of that kind of extravagance in a country at war is just nauseating. It's obscene. I mean, I read an article in a magazine called Portfolio about how the pornography business is being put out of business by amateurs who want to be on doing pornography on the internet. But it seems, and the author of the article is pointing out how obscenity was a plague in America. But when I think of the incredible extravagance of very rich people in wartime, that seems to me like the real obscenity. Anyway, we also have an education crisis of the first degree. When I was a child, all our test scores were always going up, and we were all great kids. But then, somehow, in the late 70s and 80s and 90s, test scores started to not go up anymore and started to go down. And this is a huge, huge problem. Many, many young Americans don't know history, don't know geography, don't know anything except, I guess, how to get high. And education is a key element in forming human capital. If American young people, especially young people who are not already rich, or at least upper middle class, are not going to acquire education, they're going to sink farther and farther down the income and wealth ladder, and the whole country is going to see a collapse in wealth and social mobility. You know, I was just on TV with Robert Reich, and just moments before I came over here, and he was saying we've got to have a political movement that lifts the middle class out of their middle classness into upper classness. And I said, I don't think that can be done by the government. It can only be done by people working and saving. And as a parent of a teenager, I see very scary auguries about that. The modern young person, there are plenty of them who do want to work, but there are also plenty who don't work, and there are plenty who don't learn anything. And I don't blame the teachers for this. I blame the students themselves. I mean, the teachers are working hard. It is a hard job being a teacher. I've been a teacher. It's a hard job. And I taught in a very privileged setting, mostly at UC Santa Cruz. Even there, it was kind of hard. It's very hard teaching kids who are stoned all day long. But anyway, young people just have to get into their heads that it's very, very important for them to learn. And I'm mindful of an anecdote, which I think conveys this situation better than I could convey it by data. Just recently, I concluded a stint being the co-host of a show on VH1 called America's Most Smartest Model. And we took about 1,600 young men and women who told us they were models anyway, and we tested them, and we winnowed it down to 16, 8 men and 8 women, and gave them various tests to see which of them was America's most smartest model. We were aware of the grammatical and usage error. One day, around the middle of the event, I was talking to two of the ones who'd been evicted from the show and who were waiting around to do something before they went back to their lives, doing, I shudder to think what. But anyway, one of them said, there was a young man and a young woman, and the young man said, "Wow, you sure know a lot, Ben." And I said, "Well, I'm a lot older than you. I mean, I don't really know that much. I'm just a lot older than you." He said, "How old are you?" And I said, at the time, I was 62. I said, "Well, I'm 62. And he said, "Wow." And I said, "Well, let's do a little test right here." I said, "Who was present when I was born?" So they think. And the guy says, "Abraham Lincoln." And I said, no, I said, "Not Abraham Lincoln." So they think, and they say, "Well, we can't think of any other presidents." I said, "Okay, I'm going to give you a clue. A very big war was raging when I was born, and it was raging all around the world, and it was not the first of its kind. So let's start by seeing if you can tell me which war that was." So they think, and the girl says, young woman says, "Civil War?" And I said, no, I said, "Not the Civil War." So they think, we can't think of any other wars. Okay, it was the Second World War. "Oh, we've heard of that. So I said, "All right, who was president during the Second World War?" "We don't know." "Okay, Franklin Delano Roosevelt." "All right, I'm going to make it really easy for you. Here's some questions. Who did we fight in World War II? They both simultaneously say, "Germany." "Right." I said, "Very good. Who else did we fight against in World War II? "Russia." "No, Russia was on our side in World War II. And I might add, a damn good thing, too." They said, "Oh." So I said, "Well, so then who else did we fight against in World War II? The guy says, "Germany." I said, "You already said Germany." He said, "All right, I don't know. And I said, "All right, well, let me just give you a hint. We fought the war in the European theater of operations and in the Pacific theater of operations. Who did we fight against in the Pacific theater of operations?" They think. The guy says, "Germany." I said, "No, Germany is not in the Pacific. Who did we fight against in the Pacific?" The guy thinks. He says, "Russia." I said, "No, I already told you Russia was on our side." So they say, "We can't think of it. We can't figure it out." So I said, "All right, I'm going to make it really easy. It's an island nation that produces very good quality cars." They think. The guy says, "Germany?" "No, not Germany. It was Japan." The guy says, "We fought a war against Japan. Who won?" So then the guy says, or maybe it was the woman, I've forgotten right now, says, "Wow, you know so much, it's amazing." And I said, "Well, I don't really think it's that much to know." I said, "But, you know, I guess we do learn a little bit of history growing up in Washington, D.C., as I did." So he says, "Oh, yeah, Washington, D.C., where it rains all the time, they have those big trees." And I said, no, that's Washington State. And he said, "Well, what's the difference?" And I said, "Well, Washington, D.C. is a little enclave between Maryland and Virginia, where the federal government has most of its offices. And Washington State is a big state in the Pacific Northwest where, on the coast, it does rain a lot and there are some big trees." The woman says, which is which? So anyway, and the media feeds this relentlessly by telling people it's not cool to study. It's not cool to be smart. It's not cool to know anything. It's cool to sing and dance and fight. I mean, you don't see people answering knowledge questions on American Idol. Anyway, but I think the main quality in America, problem in America right now is lack of community. Martin Luther King Jr. said many, many brilliant things, but he said something that haunts me all the time. He said, America, by its technology and wealth, has become a neighborhood, but not a brotherhood. And if he were speaking now, of course, he would have said a sisterhood as well. We have gained money, technological luxury, amazing access to material goods, but we don't give that much of a damn about our neighbor. We are a neighborhood, but not a brotherhood or a sisterhood. We see much too much of Americans behaving as if their neighbors were looting opportunities instead of people to be cared about or cared for. Nobody cares very much about his neighbors. Nobody cares very much about his neighbor's kids. It's a scary, insular, walled-off world. Part of the time, wifey and I live in a house down in the desert in a gated community. And that's, it seems to be, what a simile for what all of America is. We're all sort of within ourselves living in a gated community. Even if we're not actually behind gates, we are in a way behind gates because we don't really care about each other. We just want to live as good a life as we can and wall off the rest of the world from us. And I don't understand how you could explain the looting of America by its top corporate officers, except they don't care about their stockholders as neighbors and brothers and sisters. How else? Thank you, sweetie pie. I call 99% of my conversation is with my wife, so I've learned to call everybody in the world sweetie pie. It's really funny when I'm like calling the auto club because my car won't start, and I say to the guy, sweetie pie, how long will it take you to come fix my car? But anyway, how else can we explain top corporations looting their stockholders mercilessly, except that they don't care about them as brothers and sisters? How else can we explain the incredible misconduct of corporate officers in terms of their paying themselves excessively and illegally by illegally timed stock options, or I should say illegally mistimed stock options? How can we explain the incredible misconduct of the traders who move markets, cause people's hopes and dreams to be dashed so that they can make money selling short? How can we explain that except by lack of community? It seems to me we're seeing that kind of thing right now in America with the subprime. It's not by its numbers an economic disaster, but it's a moral and ethical disaster. How else can you explain the insurance fraud and endless litigation except that people see each other as looting opportunities? And again, this is the message of the culture. What you do in life is mostly get rich, and it doesn't matter how you do it as long as you do it. And here people say to me all the time, well, that's just the way things are. This is a big country where money is the god, and this is how things are. It can't be improved. This is just the way it is. And I say it's got to be improved because we're not a nation of shared ethnicity or blood. We're of many different bloodlines. What holds us together is not being Greeks or Jews or Germans or Irish or Italians or African Americans or Hispanics or Asians. It's ethical principles. It's teaching community, hard work, study, respect for elders. If we don't have those things, the society cannot hold together. Fascination with Lindsay Lohan, who I see, by the way, is writing her autobiography, will bind us together. I've already reserved mine on Amazon. Fascination with that will hold us together for a while. Fascination with the Emmys and the stars' dresses at the Oscars will hold us together. But getting rich quick is going to tear us apart, sincerely, if we don't have a higher moral code. Martin Luther King Jr. said the solution was agape, which was to love all of your neighbors because they're all children of God and all made in his image. And therefore, we have to love all of them because God loves them. And I spend more of my time listening to the speeches of Martin Luther King on disc than probably just about any other thing I do while conscious. And I've gotten that into my head, and it haunts me. And people say to me all the time, well, where do you see this agape? And I say, well, I tell you where I see it. I see it in the military. People say to me all the time, well, what do you mean? And I say, well, I have a friend named Colonel David McCarthy. He's a lieutenant colonel in the Marines, and he's been in Iraq 3 times and Afghanistan 2x, each time for a year. He hasn't been home much. And I guess not quite a year each time. And I say to him, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? You don't even seem that really convinced about the war. Why are you doing it? And he said, because when I'm there, I feel like people care about me. There's a guy on my right who'd give his life for me. There's a guy on my left who'd give his life for me. There's a guy in front of me who'd give his life for me. There's a guy behind me who'd give his life for me. And that's what I like about being there. I don't feel that way. When I'm on the freeway in Orange County, I feel like people would just as soon kill me as look at me. And they don't. Nobody cares about me. My men and women who are with me in the Marines care about me. And this leads me to something that happens to me all the time. I have a house part of the time in Malibu. And I live near Barbara Streisand and Nick Nolte. It's a very, very modest house, but it's in a good... It is. It's a very, very modest house, but it's in... It really is. I'm not kidding. And it's a total mess because I live there. But anyway, but it's near a lot of famous people. And people say to me, what's it like living near the stars? And I say all the time, I don't live near the stars. I live near actors, and I live near musicians and singers who have voices like Butta. But I don't live near the real stars. The real stars are the firemen who go into buildings when they're burning down and risk their lives. The real stars are the policemen who will risk their lives and get up and leave their cars in any day or any night in the middle of the night and possibly lay down their lives. The real stars are the school teachers who are teaching in schools so dangerous that they could be killed if they call a student to account. The real stars are the men and women putting on body armor in 130-degree heat in Baghdad and Ar-Ramadi and Mosul and Kirkuk and all over Afghanistan and Iraq. Those are the real stars, not Barbara Streisand and Nick Nolte. And they're the people from whom we could learn a lesson about what it takes to build agape and community. And we don't even have to go that far. We can do it within our own little circles. And I'm going to close with this little anecdote about how I learned in my own teeny tiny little way to have some bit of love for my fellows. In 1988, a suggestion came popping into my head. And it was that I would never be the best writer in the world, not even remotely in the universe of that consideration. I'd never even remotely be a good actor because I can only play myself. I'd never ever be a particularly famous economist, although I'm always introduced on TV as a famous economist. I always say, well, I'm famous and I'm an economist, but I'm not a famous economist. But anyway, there was something I could be, which is I could be the best son my mother and father had ever had. I was their only son, so I had a very good shot at it. And so I decided that I would make it my goal for the balance of their lives or mine, whichever came first, to be the best son I could. They lived in Washington, D.C. at the Watergate, and I made a plan, which I fulfilled, to visit them every 4 weeks for 4 or 5 days, just sit with them, hear their stories, hear my mother talk about her life growing up in a small town in New York in the Depression, losing her father when she was 9 years old, being lonely and scared, going off to college when she didn't know anyone at age 15, and studying and studying and studying, never quite getting it. And that's what she said. She did graduate Phi Beta Kappa from Barnard, but she claimed she never understood it. Anyway, my father growing up in Detroit, facing terrible anti-Semitism all around him, his own father, my grandfather, being unemployed for most of the Great Depression, my father going off to Williams College, very, very, very fine college, paying for it in part by washing dishes in the basement of the Sigma Phi fraternity, which absolutely, without question, would not admit a Jew. And when I asked him about it years later, were you angry that you were working down there above a soapy sink washing the dishes at a fraternity that wouldn't admit you because you're a Jew? He said, no, I wasn't angry. I was grateful to have a job during the worst depression in history where I could send myself to a great college. By the way, that's the attitude that made him a great man. My father's stories about being in the Navy during World War II, where he lost part of his hearing, but just endless stories. And my mother would tell me stories over and over and over again, the same stories. And I would listen to them and never say I'd heard them before. Watch them watch the Redskins, watch them watch the Bullets and the Kings, and watch them watch all the sports they watched on TV. And after I'd done that for a few years, my mother wrote me a letter saying, I never thought anyone would pay as much attention to me as you have. I never thought anyone would understand what I've been through as much as you have. And my father and I would go for long walks through Washington, and he would say, I never thought I would have a son who would keep me company like this and be my best friend. And I thought, this is just great. I hope this goes on forever. But of course it never does. And on April 21st, 1997, my mother awoke feeling very cold and a losing feeling in her limbs. And she was dead by 3 o'clock of congestive heart failure. And my father was devastated beyond words. You cannot imagine. They'd been together for 60 years. I had never even seen my father look at another woman. If a beautiful woman walked down the street, he would avert his eyes, the exact opposite of me. And he was lonely and very, very sad. And I kept him company for weeks, months on end, listening to his stories. Finally, little by little, he came out of his sorrow and started to go out. And he actually met a woman who had recently lost her husband, quite a prominent family in Washington. And they started keeping company. And he was happy. And he gave me credit. He said if it weren't for my encouraging him, he would have stayed home all the time. And he wrote me a fax on my birthday in 1998 saying, to the best son in the world, my confidant, my advisor, my best friend. He was a frugal guy, so he sent us a fax. But anyway, he was happy, and I thought, this is great, and this will go on forever. But, of course, it never does. And on June 25th of 1999, he had serious heart pain. He admitted himself to George Washington Hospital, and he never came out. And he got worse and worse and worse. They did surgery on him. It didn't work. Of course, since it's a hospital, they killed him. And he got sepsis, and he got various methicillin-resistant infections. It was very slow, and I would sit with him and watch TV, talk about the Redskins, talk about fiscal and monetary policy. He had a tracheal tube put down his throat. He would write me notes about the Redskins and about monetary policy. If I was even a few minutes late, he would write a note to the nurses, where is my son? And I have several of those notes on blood-spattered pieces of paper because they were always taking blood from him. I sometimes think he died because they drew so much blood from him. But anyway, he got sicker and sicker and sicker. He never complained. Never, never, never. I'd go crazy if I have to have blood drawn. But he never, ever complained. And I thought to myself, I can't bear this. This is the man who's been with me all my life. He's never turned me down when I asked for help. When I was a child and we had to rake leaves or bring in firewood, he would say, we'll do it together, and that cuts it in half. And he'd never turn me down for anything. We had a little yellow motorboat, a toy that we would try to start down at the reflecting pool in front of the Lincoln Memorial. We never could get the damn thing started, but we tried every Saturday for about a year, and it got to be a kind of a game. We never stopped trying. And now I thought, who's ever going to do that for me again? Who's ever going to be like that for me again? Nobody. And I thought, my father was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors for Mr. Nixon and Mr. Ford, and yes, it helped a lot getting the job at the White House. And I used to call him up sometimes and ask him for statistics or data. And I would say, only do it if you don't have anything better to do with your time. Like, you know, he's the top economic advisor of the president. He wouldn't have anything better to do with his time. And he would always say, what do you think I have to do with my time that's more important than helping my only son? Nobody's ever going to do that for me. Nobody. And so I would sit there with him and just look at him. He'd be sleeping most of the time. And it was just heartbreaking. And then one day, at the beginning of September, the doctors came to my sister and me. She came down there, too. And they said, it's hopeless. We'll give him a big overdose of morphine. I said, no, I don't want you to kill him. But if you must, take him off life support. So my sister and I sat next to him. And I said to him, I don't think he heard me because he was unconscious. But you never know what people hear. I said, Pop, you're going to see Mom. And they took him off life support. His vital signs went down and down and down. He was connected to a million monitors and machines. And my sister sat on his right hand. I sat on the left hand, reading him, holding his hand, reading him the Psalms. And I thought, my God, this guy who's always been here taking care of me is gone in moments. What am I going to do? And then I thought of something. He had given us, my sister and me, this final incredible gift of letting us take care of him. And we had shown that we could take care of him so that we would be all right when he was gone. And then at one point, a nurse came in, and she said, he's gone. And I said, but look, the vital signs are still showing. And he said, that's because he's got a ventilator on. So he and my mother are gone, and I go out to their grave quite often. And I still have their apartment. I left it just as it is, and I visit it quite often and stay there. And I look at it, and I look at all their books. They were big-time brainos. They have really serious books. They don't have their computer set to certain websites that I have it set to, but I look at them, and I look at the things they have there, and I thought, I did something right. I screwed up in so many ways. You cannot imagine. You cannot imagine the advantages I was born with, and I screwed up so many of them. But this thing I did right. I took care of my mother and father who had taken care of me. And it seems to me that's where it starts. Taking care of your family, taking care of your friends, taking care of the people you love and the people who love you, and they will take care of you in return. And then the community will take care of each other. The city will take care of each other, and the nation and people will take care of each other. And when I go visit my parents' apartment at the Watergate, which is now mine, I can see across the Potomac River to where John F. Kennedy is buried. And I can get this thought all the time that the key to all of it, the key to what I did with my parents, the key to what the teachers in the inner city schools do, the key to what the men and women fighting in Afghanistan do, the key to all of it, the key to being a good son, the key to being a good citizen, is what John F. Kennedy said when he was inaugurated in January of 1961. And I went down there as a high school student to watch him. I took the bus down there and watched him on a very cold day. He said, "We all ask God to bless this great country, and we all ask God to go to work for this great country, and we all ask God to go to work for the people we love. But here on earth, God's work must be our work." Thank you very much, Commonwealth Club. Thank you very, very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. And I am at your disposal if you want to ask a few questions. I know that this is only allowed to be a one-hour program, but if anyone has a few questions,
We have a lot of questions.
Okay.
Our thanks to Ben Stein for his comments this evening. My name is Bob Saldick, formerly chair of the Commonwealth Club and now a member of its Board of Governors. Now, we do have a lot of questions, but let me ask one of my own, Ben.
That's the way it works, pal.
got the microphone. JFK, Martin Luther King, railing against people making too much money. What kind of conservative are you?
I am an Eisenhower conservative who believes that it is irresponsible to burden our children and grandchildren with incredible indebtedness so that we can live it up, and that our goal is to leave them a prosperous country, not overly indebted, so that we could have the good times now. I'd rather have tea and not champagne so that my son doesn't inherit such a big debt.
By the way, we're honored to have you and your father both as speakers here. And can we book your son for a few years from now?
Yeah, absolutely. You can book him.
They still don't pay, but
I mean, that's what the police said when they gave him his DUI.
moving right along. We've got a lot of questions on various facets of your life. Let me start out with economics.
Okay.
First of all, there was a stimulus package announced today. Have you taken a look at it, and what do you think? Will that help?
I think it'll help. I mean, it's $145 or $150 billion. I think it'll help. I mean, the history of such things is that they don't help very much, but I think they help with the mood. Recessions have a lot to do with mood. I don't think this recession had to happen. I think it happened because the media talked people into it. The media was just endlessly, relentlessly beating the drum of fear, 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 fear. Even when things were going quite well, the media was saying they're terrible, everything's falling apart. I think the media put fear in. Fear affects the velocity of money. Fear affects the number of transactions. Fear affects every part of the economic spectrum. And I think when people know the government is trying to pour oil on the waving waters, or the waves, rather. I think that helps people feel better. Same thing as with the Federal Reserve. By itself, the cut in the interest rate doesn't really signify that much. There's already a great deal of liquidity out there. It's a sign that somebody's on your side. The government cares about it, and that's what makes you feel better. It's sort of like having your mother kiss you before you go to bed. I mean, it's not the same as having secobarbital in your bloodstream, but it makes you feel, oh, some of us are old enough to remember that. But it does soothe you and make you able to sleep better. I mean, and we want to feel that the government cares about us.
We want them to care.
If a 3/4 point drop by the Fed and a $150 billion stimulus package is read so positively by the market, and you're just seeing positive, Why didn't they drop it 2 points on a $500 billion plan? In other words, what are the downsides, the risks of all of these programs?
Well, first of all, my own feeling is they did this because the traders and the speculators and the short sellers terrified them and beat them into doing it. And I think that was incredibly irresponsible behavior by the speculators. This is really a country, let me just be the first to tell you, this is a country really in which the almighty power is presently held by the big financial speculators. They can terrify the Congress, terrify the President, terrify the Federal Reserve. These are people whose names you don't know, whose faces you don't know. You'll never see them on TV. You'll never see them in big pictures of them in the covers, on the covers of magazines. They control so much money. They can control so much trading at any given moment on the futures exchanges and the options exchanges and the stock exchanges that they can move any price of any security and terrify the people running the government. So they were caught a little bit by surprise by the extent of the Fed's move, but they could start again at any time. The only question is, do they feel they can make more money pushing it up or pushing it down? And I know some of these people, and their motto is, we love to sell into fear, because fear is bottomless. There's a limit to optimism. And so they love to sell fear, and the people in the media are their handmaidens. The CNBC, which I love being on a lot. They don't pay me, so I can say anything I want about them. You guys don't pay me either, so I can say anything I want about you. Anyway, CNBC, certain people in the major newspapers of this country just sell fear wildly beyond what is warranted. I have never once seen a piece saying, yes, there are $100 billion of mortgages in default or whatever the number is. I don't think it's that much, but suppose it is that much. There are that many in default. However, there are $20 trillion worth of mortgages. So put that in some perspective. Anyway.
In your New York Times column, you said that the biggest financial firms in the country, including Merrill Lynch, Goldman, and others, were stupid and did not understand the value of their investments.
Well, I didn't say that, with all due respect.
You said something like that.
No, I didn't say that. What I said was... two things. One, I said, as to Goldman Sachs, they are reported as having been simultaneously selling these products into the market, these gigantic mortgage-backed securities by the tens of billions, and at the same time doing short sales on that sector. And just, I'm not sure if that's illegal, but I consider it unethical to both peddle a product and also sell it short. It shows a certain conflict. The second thing I said was I don't think the people running these big firms really understood the risks of these products, and that it appalls me that, say, the former chairman of Merrill Lynch, cut the value of his firm's stock in half by his incompetence and yet left with a $162 million severance package. That is disgraceful to me. You know. He likes it.
A question, isn't the optimism for the economy outweighed by the financial obligations of the future and declining educated workforce? My hope for the future is dimmed by these. What about you?
Well, my hope for the future is dimmed by that, too. But the amazing thing is we always seem to somehow muddle through. And every other country in the world faces problems, too. There are terrible demographic challenges in the People's Republic of China, terrible demographic problems all through the industrialized world. And yet somehow we go through. I mean, it's interesting. When I was a young man, we were all worried that the Soviet was going to overtake us in terms of prosperity by the mid-60s. It didn't even remotely happen. In the 60s and 70s, we thought that the planned economy of France was the wave of the future. It didn't even remotely happen. Now we're afraid the Chinese will overtake us and they'll become the dominant power in the world. The average Chinese income per capita is between 1/15th and 1/20th that of the average U.S. worker. That's a large difference, and it's going to take a very long time for them to catch up. And by the way, it's not bad for us if they catch up. The wealthier they are, the more money they can put in losing investments in the U.S. And so the better it is for us. And the more money they have, the more they can buy things from us. And they're already a very big buyer of stuff. We don't really run that big a deficit with China. We run a very big deficit with the petrostates, but not with China.
Yes. We have several questions.
But I should say, as to education, it's a real super crisis. And I don't know what to do. I think we should bring back corporal punishment in the schools. That might help.
were those two models, was that a true story?
Oh, absolutely.
Thought I'd ask. We have several questions about the current...
Well, I appreciate your asking me if I came up and told lies to your audience, though.
Several questions about the current administration in Washington, D.C. What is your assessment of the impact of the G.W. Bush administration on society, economy, and culture, and our reputation in the world? And do you talk to President Bush? Are you a pal of his?
Well, I am somewhat of a pal of his. I mean, I thought I was a better pal of his, but I haven't been invited to sleep in the Lincoln bedroom, although time's not up yet. But I have an odd feeling about Mr. Bush, which is that I think he is personally an incredibly likable, nice guy. I mean, he's one of the most pleasant, charming guys I've ever met. But he has made so many questionable appointments. He has made appointments of such very, very dicey, questionable people to such gigantic posts, exercising such enormous responsibility. I think something's deeply wrong there. I don't know what it is, but he just doesn't seem to have taken the appointments aspect of his job very seriously, and yet that's a very, very important part of the job. And I think had he had a better person at the Defense Department, had he had a better person, and he had a good person at State, but had he been even better, had he chosen a different person for CIA, I don't think we ever would have gone into Iraq. And he continues to do that. I think he has his choice for the chairman of the SEC has been astonishingly questionable choice. I think time will tell, but I don't think Mr. Bernanke so far has been a super good choice as head of the Fed. Mr. Rumsfeld was a catastrophically bad choice. And I don't know. He admits he's not a genius guy, and he didn't really need to admit it. But he should have really taken the time to surround himself with the very best people he could, and I don't think he did. So that's, I think, the key problem.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California program on radio and on television with actor, writer, attorney, professor, and financial expert Ben Stein. You mentioned
dog lover, too. I'm a big dog fancier. We have six cats, not four, six cats. Six cats and three dogs, all rescues. We love that. It's a full-time job cleaning
but it's,
up.
But it's your own son, though.
What?
Your own son.
Our own son? No, he's a rescue too.
You mentioned President Eisenhower. President Eisenhower famously spoke to the Commonwealth Club warning us about, quote, the military-industrial complex. Is America constantly at war because of the profit involved in wartime industries?
Well, that speech was not given at the Commonwealth Club, by the way. That speech was given from the White House. But anyway, I don't think it's that. I mean, the people who make money in wartime industries make plenty of money when we're not at war either. No, I don't think it. And defense procurement is a very, very small part of the economy. And the people who run the defense business are very modestly paid compared with people in many other fields in the country. I think it's we have real enemies. We have real serious enemies who really seriously want to hurt us. And we sometimes make the wrong decisions about how to fight them. And I don't think it was at all a mistake to invade Afghanistan. But obviously Iraq has been a super big problem, and I'm very, very, very worried about the future there, although the surge seems to be working, but this you can't just keep surging forever, and I keep thinking there are however many of those guys we kill or arrest, there are a lot more of them waiting to take their place. So I don't know. In answer to the question, no, I don't think it has to do with profit.
There's an election going on. Several people ask where you stand these days. Have you decided who to support in the upcoming election, and would you share it with us on a confidential basis?
Well, I am a Republican. That's not a secret, but I'm not allowed to say who I support because It is because the New York Times has a rule against, and this is really a joke for those of you who read the New York Times, they don't want their columnists to be too openly political. So I say, well, I wonder whether Krugman is a Democrat or a Republican. That's a good question. How about that guy, Bob Herbert? I wonder if he's a Democrat or a Republican. Anyway, I am a Republican, but I haven't decided who I support, and I'm not allowed to say in any event.
We did have Krugman here recently, and he wouldn't tell us either.
Yeah, it's a. Did he tell you whether he was a Democrat or Republican?
No, he said he worked for the New York Times.
Yeah. Okay.
What do you think of having a bailout plan for those who have defaulted on their loans? What about a bailout plan for the banks? And you sort of suggested that.
I think the Federal Reserve should make it very clear they're not going to allow any bank of any sizable dimensions to fail. If it takes a bailout, then do that. Although I hate rescuing these people who caused all this misery by their own greed and stupidity, but the effects of not doing anything would be even worse. A bailout plan for buyers is that's beyond my ability to figure out, because obviously some of them were behaving fraudulently and some were not, and I don't know how you figure out which ones were which. So I just don't know the answer to that.
One of the candidates for president is pushing a consumption tax. Is that an idea we should consider sometime?
Is that Ron Paul? Who is that? Who's going to put?
No.
Who is that?
It's Huckabee.
Huckabee. Well, I mean, it's a consumption tax is not a bad idea. It's not a terrible idea. It would bear very, very heavily on me. But the tax already bear very heavily on me. So it's fine. It's a fine idea. It's not as good as some of his other ideas, like changing the Constitution to conform to the Bible. But it's a good idea.
What are your thoughts about the future of the U.S. dollar versus the euro? And what about all those dollars that the Chinese and the Indians and all the others are holding?
Well, I think the dollar has a long, long way to fall. I don't see any bottom for the dollar. I mean, it will fluctuate around a descending mean, but I don't see any clear bottom for the dollar. Unless something drastic happens to interest rates and we keep our interest rates higher than the European Central Bank, but that's exactly the opposite of what's happening. So I don't foresee any good news about a strong dollar. And by the way, I don't know if we even want a strong dollar. Here we have a good friend of mine who works at a huge computer software company. I'm sure he'd like a weak dollar so they can export more things. So there are many benefits to a weak dollar. It's very amazing, though, traveling in Europe with the dollar being what it is. It's a real slap in the face.
Here's a questioner who's feeling better about the future. And they say, despite global warming, the Iraq quagmire, Rwanda genocide, etc., I am very pleased and proud of human progress. Our technological prowess has grown faster than our psychological development, but morally, ethically, we are making great progress. Could you please
speak? I think that's exactly right.
Your sense
totally,
of optimism.
In this country, absolutely. I mean, in this country, absolutely. I think the progress this country has made morally and ethically has been breathtaking. I consider this the greatest achievement of mankind by far, and it's just an amazing country. It's just incredible to think that we have a country this big that is governed by the governed, albeit, to be sure, heavily, heavily influenced by the very rich, and in which everybody has legal rights. It's an astonishing country. It's just the greatest thing that there's ever been. It is really a gift from God. You know, years ago, I said to my father, you know, Dad, I said, it just occurs to me that we Jews live better in America than Jews have ever lived at any time anywhere else in the world. He said, the essence of America is that everybody lives better than his forebears did anywhere, whether they're from Italy or Ireland or China or anywhere or Africa or Asia or anywhere. Everybody lives better in America. That's what America is all about. It's heavenly being here. When I spend a lot of time in Idaho. I don't know how many of you go to Idaho, but it's very beautiful, mountainous country where I go. And when I drive around there and think to myself, this beautiful country belongs to me, even though I'm a Jew, it belongs to me as much as it belongs to anybody else. And I can do anything I want here. I can get out and look at the stars at night. I can get out take my boat into the river, in the Pendere River. I can stop and eat incredibly good veggie burgers at this great restaurant I go to in North Idaho. It's paradise. It's just paradise. I have a swimming pool, and it's warm. I keep it very warm at night, and I swim in at night and look up at the stars, and I just think, this is paradise. This is just paradise. So it's glorious.
God, we should end there.
Fine with me. Thank you.
No, we're not. Let me. I've asked you some easy questions. Let's ask a really hard one for a show business veteran.
Is this going to be a mathematical question?
No. Being a showbiz veteran, how would you solve the Hollywood writers' strike, and will it be solved before the Oscars?
Oh, I think my friends. Well, I am a member of the Writers Guild, but I am. Can I say an obscenity on this show?
Yes.
Well, I won't though. I won't. I'm reminded of who here remembers John Connolly, the former Secretary of the Treasury. Okay, so years and years ago, before the dollar was severed from gold, the Belgians were threatening that they had a large stock of gold. And they were threatening. A large stock of dollars, they were threatening to demand gold, which would have just taken all of our gold because we didn't have that much gold. And Mr. Nixon said to John Connolly, well, what are we going to do if the Belgians ask for gold? And John Connolly said, I'll take that little Belgian fellow and I'll beat the crap out of him. And if it were up to me, that's what I would do with the heads of the Writers Guild, who never should have gone on strike. And it's going to turn out to have been a long, painful strike. And I think the benefits are going to be very modest. And I think it was just them showing off. And I really disapprove of it very, very much. And if they don't like it, tough.
A film you participated in was called Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, which conducted interviews on the intersection of science and religion. Apparently, this film supported intelligent design, who pushed creationism as an alternative to the theory of evolution. Where do you stand on this issue?
That's not true. But that's anyway, not true. I am the narrator of a movie which has not actually been finished yet, so I'm not quite sure that this fellow could have seen it. But anyway, this lady could have seen it. But the movie is a movie in which we ask a lot of questions, like we ask Darwinists, well, assuming Darwinism is true, what do you think its effects were on National Socialism? What do you think its effects were on the Holocaust? Because we interviewed a number of historians of the Holocaust who said that the Holocaust was explicitly the working out of Darwinist theory, in the sense that Hitler was a very, very avid Darwinist who believed in the superiority of the Aryan race and believed that all other races were just consuming scarce resources and they should be either killed or worked to death. And we actually came across a number of people very familiar with that era who said, absolutely, it's absolutely true. It was Hitler and his people were following a combination of Darwinism and Malthusianism. So we wanted to explore what that was all about and whether there was anything similar lurking in the world today. We also wanted to ask people, well, assume evolution is correct, because it does seem to be an extremely powerful theory and practice and whatever you want to call it. Could you tell us even one species that has been observed evolving? And we haven't come upon one yet, but we may. I'm sure somebody's going to come upon one. And third, we said, well, even if Darwinism is a most brilliant theory ever, and it may very well be one of the most brilliant theories and maybe in practice ever, where did the laws of physics come from that govern the movement of water and other solids and other matter in the world? Where did gravity come from? Where did thermodynamics come from? Where do all the laws that operate to keep the universe in motion come from? Where's it all begin? And we especially wanted to know, where did organic matter begin? At one point, there was inorganic matter. Then there was organic matter. What happened to change it? And we talked to very, very, very big powers in the world of Darwinism, and nobody could ever give us a serious answer. So we would like to just sort of pursue this and actually hope to get somebody asking these questions. I don't, for myself, question that Darwinism is an incredibly, unbelievably important contribution to man's understanding of the universe. But I also think it doesn't go anywhere near far enough towards explaining all the things that we would like to know, and I think we were trying to point out some of the things that have yet to be learned.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's time for only one last question, but I'm going to ask you two.
Is this your question?
No, it's okay. Not. You'll think it is.
Okay.
The first one is from an economist.
Well, this sounds like two questions. Okay, go ahead.
On the other hand, he says, or she says, I wonder how an economist got his own TV game show.
Good question.
And the second question, and this one could have come from me, has your Jewish background influenced your humor or career in any way?
First of all, hugely, in part because when I was growing up, a number of careers were closed to Jews. I mean, it's hard to believe, but when I was in eighth grade, I wrote a paper for eighth grade something or other, civics class, I think it was, about the three careers I wanted to do, and I wrote banking because I lived in a town where the only air-conditioned building in the town was a bank. So I thought, well, I want to be in an air-conditioned building no matter what. Second, I said automobile design because I've always loved cars. And third, advertising because I've always loved advertising. And during the 50s, we had great ads. And my father looked at my little paper and he said, most of those jobs just aren't open to Jews. Commercial banking is not really open to Jews. The car business is pretty much closed to Jews. And advertising is largely, although not entirely, closed to Jews. So think of something else. So anyway, I thought of something else. And so what was question one? That was a long time ago.
The question was as an economist, he wondered how an economist got his own TV game show.
Because I was friends. My very best friend in the whole world is a fellow named Al Burton, who actually lives up in this area in a place called San Mateo with his lovely wife, Sally. And hi, Al and Sally. And Al thought up this idea for a show, and he couldn't think of anyone else who could answer a lot of questions besides me. And actually, when we started rehearsing for it, I said, I'm not going to be able to do this. You're going to have to give me the answers. And they said, well, of course we'll give you the answers. And I said, well, are you sure you're going to give me the answers? He said, yes. So after we'd been in rehearsals, and then it was sold, and then we had about 2 days to go before we were going to go on the air, I said, well, nobody's explained to me yet how you're going to give me the answers. Are you going to, like, whisper them to me in the dressing room? And they said, we're not going to tell you the answers. And I said, well, you have to tell me the answers. I can't possibly do it if you don't tell me the answers. And they said, well, you're just going to have to do your best. I said, well, but I'll be so embarrassed if I lose. And they said, well, we want you to lose. That's the whole point of the show. There's no show if you don't lose. So anyway, so I did it, and I didn't lose that money. So it was great. Anyway, God bless you all. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
Our thanks to Ben Stein, actor, writer, attorney, professor, and financial expert. This program has been part of our Toby American Value Series, generously underwritten by the Toby Family Foundation. We thank our audiences here on the radio and on television. I'm Bob Saldick, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you so much.
You were great.